Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Dr. David Alfrey. His book is Saving Grace, What Patients Teach Their Doctors About Life, Death, and the Balance in Between. Dr. Alfrey is an anesthesiologist from Nashville. He's been retired for a few years. He's also an inventor who holds many patents related to his specialty, and now he's an author. This book gives us a clear picture of the table in the OR, where Dr. Alfrey takes you closer to death than you will ever come and then brings you back to this world, all while major surgery is going on and during which your life is truly in the balance between this world and the next. It's a topic, hospital surgery and death itself, that we kind of want to stay away from, both in our minds and in reality. Yet the unmasking of its mysteries is what this book is all about. And the stories are told with clinical precision, empathy, and grace, and with an eye toward the spirit of life and perhaps the spark that gives it to us with love. Hi, Dr. Alfrey. Welcome to Avid Reader.
Yeah. Hi, Sam. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, so being a bookstore owner, I'm always interested in the cover because all of my patrons are interested in the cover too. So tell us a little bit about that and whose hand is under yours.
Well, that's a wonderful, I'm so glad you asked that question. That is my hand on my daughter's hand. And the thought is that, can I show the
Oh yeah, please do. Yeah, that's the best thing you can do.
All right, so this is the cover. And it has my hand on my daughter's hand. And it's meant to depict an older physician with a hand over a younger patient comforting them. It was the thought of it was given to me by my nephew, who's a big artist, and he's done the movie posters for Lion King, The Avengers, Guardians of the Galaxies, a bunch of the Stranger Things shows. So he suggested it, and my son-in-law took the picture and he photoshopped it. So it's a family affair. I'm just so excited to have that particular picture on the cover.
That's funny. You're talking about your family because in the acknowledgments, you say something at the end of them. And I wondered for a moment why you said it, but you said, when you're dedicating it to your daughters, you say, I wish I could turn back the clock.
Yeah.
And I think about that too. Why'd you say that? Because it's so, I feel it the same way.
Yeah. You know, there's very few doctors that when they retire say, I wish I had worked a little bit harder. You know, I just found myself in a practice that we were always behind. We were always working too hard. There were times when if you took vacation, they'd say, well, you can't leave town because if we need you, we'll call you in. So I just worked so hard. And as a result, my wife did most of the child rearing.
The other thing that I'm always interested in is the epigraph. And yours is, rather than me reading it, why don't you read it?
The
beginning epigraph from Hebrews.
Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need.
And the interesting thing about that is the word grace is used twice. And I like epigraphs because I always feel like the author thinks about them a lot.
Well, yes. You know, I went through a lot of titles for this book. Gosh, it started with Rest Assured, and then it was We Only Charge for Waking You Up, and a number of other titles. And we ended up with Saving Grace because...
Much better.
Yeah, much better. I won't tell you about the title we had for about 3 days. It was Woke Up Dead. That didn't go over well. But Saving Grace was picked because, you know, there's always some saving grace in every tragedy that we find in life or in medicine. And there are things that happen in life and in medicine that are just so fantastic that they just beat the odds that you can say, well, what a coincidence, what a series of coincidences, how lucky you were. And to me, it's grace that you were given. And then finally, we had a patient named Grace, and sadly, there was no saving grace.
And that's the patient that was burned horribly, and your colleague said, damn drunk drivers.
Yes. Yeah, that's in the introduction, and that was one of the great lessons I learned in medicine that I was able to carry through in my entire medical practice. The idea that it's a privilege to take care of patients.
Well, you know, it's funny because that first part of the book really hits you hard. I mean, you're talking about a human being in a bed that you no longer recognize as a human being. And that goes to the idea of medicine and the Hippocratic Oath. And, you know, in my opinion, she's better off dead, but yes. You don't have that luxury. And so that was poignant and fascinating because, you know, there's no hope. And even if there was, it's just a life of constant excruciating pain.
Yes, it was an absolute tragedy. And for the viewers and listeners out there, there's a 19-year-old girl that had been horribly, horribly burned in a drunk driving accident. And we took care of her for a few weeks. We prolonged her life. And then she died. And my resident had to talk to the family about the death. And what do you say to a family who's watched their daughter suffer for 2 or 3 weeks in the hospital? The only known thing is that if she does live through this, she'll just be horribly disfigured for the rest of her life. And after she died, and Dr. Carter had told the patient's family that, I thought, I mean, what do you say to a family? And the very last thing he said was, I want you to know it was a privilege to take care of your daughter.
Yeah,
it makes sense. I get teary when I say that. I go back to that room and I carry that with me for my entire medical practice, realizing that when you take care of another human being, it's an absolute privilege.
Yeah, and the thing I got teary when you said it too, because you can't help it. But the thing that really got to me is that here you are years and years and years after that. And just now, as I saw you, you still have the same empathy and you still have the perfect recollection. What do you owe that to? I wouldn't be able to do it. You're taking this all home with you. And then your wife, poor wife, either listens to it or you.
Yeah, poor wife.
And she seems like a wonderful person.
She is.
So you have all this emotion, you're driving home and you talk about it many times, and I wouldn't be able to do it. And I also wouldn't be able to be as idealistic as you.
Well, I don't know. You learn to compartmentalize part of it. You have these terrible tragedies that you see, that you participate in. And I think that we just as humans have a way of just sort of tucking them away in a box. But there's no doubt that they're in that box. And I think, you know, not to dramatize it, but like a soldier revisiting or some traumatic event in anybody's life, you go back to it and it's pretty indelibly seared into your brain, and you really remember it like yesterday. A couple of the events in the book with this Joe Slaughter, orthopedist, I had a little book release party the other day, and his scrub tech, I call him Pat Yanyek in the book, and he came to the party as a surprise. And he said, David, I read your book, and he was just blown away. And I said, was I accurate, those two events in the OR? And he said, I remember them exactly the same way. So I think that we experience these things that are really pivotal in our lives, and they don't go away. They're there forever.
And each of these stories you put in a kind of box by calling it either the chapter, either respect or dignity or trust or gratitude or suffering or faith. And each of them kind of, it's like kind of a gnomon for the rest of the paragraph, or sorry, the best rest of the chapter. And respect is an interesting one at the beginning, because you're talking about not only your cadaver, this little old lady, but then you talk about the introduction of your wife in the same chapter as the cadaver.
Yeah. First of all, you know, I chose all those titles because those are, you know, the subtitle is the what patients teach their doctors about life, death, and the balance in between, and how much I learned from these experiences and from my patients. And each of the titles is what I learned from patients in that. The respect refers to not one of my better days. It was when the first day of my medical school class, and we had our cadavers for gross anatomy. And the professor said, now look, treat these cadavers with reverence and with total respect. They've donated their bodies. And I could have cared less about what he was saying. I was just excited to start dissecting and what I could learn from this person. And it wasn't a person to me. And it was only later that I look back and say, and said, you know, you were so naive. You're so disrespectful. You had so much to learn other than anatomy. And then I talk about meeting my wife, where I was just dazzled by her. You know, it's one of those things that you just get knocked off your feet and you think, well, she's a model. She's got a boyfriend. I don't have a chance.
Yeah, I've been there. And the other thing is, you know, I've been in one of those relationships too, where you follow each other around because you can't help it.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she always talks about how that she chased me for 3 years until I caught her.
Yeah, that's the other thing is, you just mentioned it about your lack of respect. You're very candid in the book, and you're very candid about your errors and how you learned from them. And for example, in the paralysis chapter, you know, you need to know when to call a code. But
yeah,
in that chapter, how the hell did you get up on the bed? I don't understand your posture.
Oh, that was the next one. Right. On intubating the patient.
Right.
You know, first of all, in terms of being candid, the book would not be worth writing if I wasn't just going to be as totally honest with it. And fortunately, as I got later in my career, I was a little more mature, and I think I grew into what I became. But all doctors, I think, start, you know, very naive, a little puffed up. Oh, I'm going to be a doctor, or I'm a new doctor, whatever it might be. And then the practice knocks you down and beats a little bit of humility into you. And I just thought that I have to depict these things as they really happened. And in writing truthfully, I found that I could write easily because I didn't have to make anything up. I could just say, this is what happened, for good, bad, or indifferent.
How'd you get up on the bed?
Yeah, this is I think the chapter on gratitude, where right. it's chapter five, where I'm called to intubate a patient, and I got called a lot of times. You know, they always call the anesthesiologist to pass the breathing tube. And I got called a lot of times to the ICU, patients in just terrible extremis. And they're in respiratory failure. And often, like this patient, it was unlikely that he was ever going to have that breathing tube removed. And I had a terrible, terrible difficulty in putting it in. And the last thing he said, he just struggled to get words out. And the last thing he said, mouthed it more than said it, was, thank you. And I'm going to get emotional through this whole book. I'm sorry.
So have those emotions. So
it was just, I had many times knowing that the last words a patient ever said in this life were to me, and they were, thank you. An unknown doctor there just to try to help him, to put a breathing tube in the hopes that he had something reversible, that we could take it out and he'd live a little more. But most of them would not. You talked about how I called up on the bed. This is what we routinely did to intubate someone in an ICU bed. You take the top of the frame off the headboard, and you jump up onto the base of it, and you've got the head of the bed leaned up, so your shins are pressed against this metal. And if it took a while to intubate, and if it was a struggle, I mean, those shins were burning. And I got a text message from one of my professors from my residency yesterday. He said, David, I read your book in one day. It's the most accurate depiction of the OR I've ever read. And he said, my shins were burning when you were intubating that patient. because, you know, he could remember times that he had crawled up on beds and the burning shins as you're trying to get that breathing tube in. So it was really nice that it could resonate with that kind of reality to him.
There's a lot of similarities between your book and Sherwin Nuland's book, like How We Die, especially the first chapter of that, because, you know, he's talking about the death rattle and he never heard of it. Mm-hmm. And that, the other thing is that you talk about, which to me would be the hardest thing in medicine, is going into that little quiet room to talk to the family, because you've had it hundreds of times.
Yeah, for those who don't know, there's a room called the quiet room. And they're in every hospital. They are next to ICUs. Sometimes they're near a nurse's station. But they're a room where you go in, you close the door. They're pretty soundproof, generally don't have windows. And they're nondescript, you know, sofa, a couple chairs, because they're there just for one reason, and that's to talk to the patient's families. And often it's the most terrible conversation that family will ever engage in. And in the introduction, I talk about Dr. Carter and us going into that quiet room to tell that burn patient's family that she had expired. They're pretty sobering places.
That was really nice of you to go in along with them. You didn't have to.
Well, you know, when you're in training, you are tagging along. You know, someone is teaching you, that generally the person a year ahead of you, sometimes a couple of years ahead, and it was part of your job to, you know, to be with them, to see how they did things. And as I said in the introduction, when I said that by saying it was a privilege to take care of your daughter, that Dr. Carter had given the parents a gift that they could take with them after they buried their daughter, he had given me a gift as well.
When you talk about tagging along, it reminded me, because you, I don't know if you take issue with it, but it's the old saw that everyone knows, you know, watch one, do one,
teach see one, do one, teach one. Yeah. And, you know, that's a euphemism, you know, that we use in medicine, as if I could, you know, let's just say I could see the most complicated procedure. I've seen it once. Okay, I can do it. And after I've done it once, now I can go teach it. And it's sort of poking fun at the idea that medicine is that easy. And of course, you know, there are some things that are that easy, but there are plenty of things that you have to see it for a year or two before you can even approach doing it.
Well, it's like I was going to say poor Mrs. Moskowitz, but it's not poor Mrs. Moskowitz, because she was really cool, because she put all her trust. She goes, let's go ahead and do it today. And that's the other thing, you know, you're telling me you're scared to death. And I'm thinking, I don't know if I'd want this doctor doing this his first time. Tell that story.
Yeah. I was working in the pain clinic, and I was very young in my practice, maybe 3 years in. And a patient came in for a cervical epidural. And everybody's heard about epidurals for labor and delivery. That's in the lower back. But if you've got an irritated nerve root into the arm, then you do an epidural back here. And that carries with it real hazard, because if the needle goes in too far, you can cause quadriplegia and you could kill a patient. And I had never done one. I'd seen a few. And Mrs. Moskowitz came in to have one of my partners do it, a seasoned partner, but he wasn't there. So I got her ready. And she said, well, if you're here today, why don't you do it? And I kind of stammered a little bit. And she noticed that and said, how many of these have you done? And I admitted that I hadn't done any, but I'd seen them. And I thought I could do them, kind of half hoping that she'd say, I think I'll wait for Dr. Bob. But she said, well, I'm game, let's do it. And a lot of things in medicine, you do, even if you haven't seen someone do it before. Once you finish your training, maybe you see a video of it. And when I finished my training, there were no videos out there. So there are a lot of things that you just had to decide, okay, I think I'm ready for this, and go do it.
Yeah, it's like jumping into a cold swimming pool. But it's like, the thing about that one was, first time in, you didn't quite get it, you know? And then that's when I would be scared to death.
And I was scared to death. So I'm putting the needle in, and I get far enough, and I think, man, I should be there by now. And so I pulled it out, and, you know, and she gave a little squeak, and I said, I'm going to go in at a different angle, thinking, man, am I going to get it this time? And then all of a sudden I was there, and this, you know, this enormous sense of relief. And then I put the steroid in and pull it out, and thinking, well, she'll wait for Dr. Bob for the other two. And she says, well, that went well. You do the other two. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord. Okay. But that is part of the magic of medicine. And that is this unbelievable trust that we're given. And as an anesthesiologist, it was just so amazing that I could meet a patient in the holding area. Hi, I'm Dr. Alfrey. I'm your anesthesiologist. And, you know, we'd have a quick chat, a quick examination. And in fact, they are going to come closer to death than they'll ever come in this lifetime. And within 10 minutes, they absolutely trust me. As I said in the book, I don't know how that happens, but it's a blessing that it does. And it's one of the rewards of being a physician.
And the concept, you know, people think about it being, in addition to being a science or a profession, also art. And so in that specific chapter, it was the idea that the way you knew that you had successfully done this is just because of a sound or a texture. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard to imagine.
Well, that's the way it is. There's an unbelievable amount of art in medicine. And I think that's what physicians take issue with, this whole evidence-based medicine. Now, everything has to be evidence-based. There has to be this extensive study that has shown that this is the way to go. Well, you know, patients are complicated, and no two patients are alike. And every patient needs to have the art of medicine as well as the science of medicine. I think I say in the, you know, did my medical school in at LSU in Louisiana. And at one point in the book, I say that there's as many ways to put all of our drugs together in anesthetizing someone as it is to make gumbo in Louisiana.
I remember that.
Unlimited.
Which is also scary. Oh yeah, before we get too far into the actual emotional aspect of it, you do talk about it, and it's very important. Talk about, for our listeners, the stages of anesthesia, since you're talking about a cocktail.
Yeah, there are four stages of anesthesia, and a lot of people liken it to flying an airplane. You know, you take off and you get up to altitude and you land again. But for me, I like to think of it as a submarine. When you're on the surface, that's stage one. Stage two is when you're going down under the water. And there's a stage where you're just lightly anesthetized called the stage of excitement. And you don't want to stimulate a patient at that time, because they can go into laryngospasm, which is reflexively shutting their vocal cords. And it's just a dangerous time to be, you know, manipulating a patient. And in stage three is the stage of surgical anesthesia, where they're deeply asleep. Stage four is when you've given too much. And at some point you've given enough that the patient expires. So we start at stage one, bring them to stage three. And then when we're done, bring them back to surface and then take them into port.
Yeah, it's like one of the situations, you know, it's almost as if taking them down, especially the one patient who had cancer that had metastasized, and the family was so grateful to you for, you know, what you did. And it's almost like, I don't know whether I would be able to stop myself from just continuing to stage four and beyond in a situation.
Well, yeah, this is in the chapter suffering. And, you know, we're often called to the patients where the oncologist has done all he or she can with narcotics, and they're still suffering. They're still in pain. And these are what we call industrial strength doses, where I've had patients that are on hundreds and hundreds of milligrams of morphine per hour, and they are awake and they are in pain because they're so tolerant to the drugs. And we were called to see a patient who was on a very high dose of Dilaudid, And he had that death rattle that you mentioned, just the gurgling that you come near the end of life. And he probably wasn't in pain, but the family was, because they saw him labored breathing and gurgling and moaning. And they said, "Doctor, you have to help him." And I felt like he's really insensitive to this. He's really not responding, but I think I have to help you, the family. And so we hooked up a propofol infusion. And propofol is the medicine everybody's heard about with Michael Jackson. It's an intravenous anesthetic. And I just gave a very, very light dose, because when you have all this other stuff on board, a little bit goes a long way. And that's what killed Michael Jackson. And we ran a very light propofol infusion where he was finally to the point where he was silenced. And the family could relax and he could have a quiet passing. But that was a dicey situation, because just a little bit too much and basically I would have killed him. But that's just part of the compassion of medicine, you know, just trying to relieve suffering.
Saying Michael Jackson reminded me of the chapter. Well, the whole book is very serious, but it's also lighthearted in a lot of ways and humorous. The funniest part was when you talked about the famous people who feel like, well, if they sign a few record albums, you will give them better treatment. It's like those commercials for Allstate with
yes. Yeah, with Patrick Mahomes. Yeah, you know, I in the epilogue, I make the comment, the observation that, you know, while during life, you know, if you're famous, if you're a star, if you've made a lot of money and all the other sort of external trappings of success, the crazy way that we value people rather than value them for who they are. But if you've had all of those things, they've meant so much in your life, but at the end, they really mean nothing.
I know. It's like, you know, you have a billionaire and he gets cancer and he knows he's going to die. He will give up every single penny.
Yes.
To live another day. Every single penny. And like my father used to say, I would say, "Oh, my friend just got a private jet, blah, blah, blah." And he would go, "All it takes is money." And it took me like 20 years to figure out what he meant.
Yeah. You know, there's a famous picture of David Geffen, you know, the rich guy, owns a movie studio now, of him in his private jet at the back seat sitting all alone. And a quote from him that is, "Anyone who thinks that money buys happiness has never had a lot of money."
That's really good.
Yeah.
Hey, it's funny. So we were talking about Mahomes and I just realized after all those commercials, I said Allstate and it's State Farm.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
All those commercials and they didn't get across to me. I would have called Allstate. That's weird.
You were focusing on Patrick Mahomes.
Yeah, he's definitely saturating the commercial airways.
Yeah.
You know, another thing that struck me, just because I've heard other doctors say this in the opposite way, anesthesiologists, I thought, didn't like CRNAs because they felt they were less expensive and that meant that they were going to take over the entire profession.
Well, you know, it's a complicated relationship. There is some antagonism between the two professional organizations. There's a lot of anesthesiologists that are practicing solo or independently doing their own cases, and they can be resentful of CRNAs trying to take their place or saying they're trying to get politically what I earned educationally. Most CRNAs work with physicians, with anesthesiologists in what's called the care team model, where we supervise, they do most of the hands-on stuff. And it's a really wonderful collaborative relationship. I think sometimes the political heads of the organizations, you know, they butt heads and they may not exactly represent their members. The CRNAs that I worked with were superbly trained, wonderful people. And I had my little book release party the other day and I had invited four of them and they came. And when they came, I told them, "You were the four people that I really wanted to have here." And you know, I just adored working with CRNAs, and I know they loved working with me.
And you put it in the acknowledgments as well. But, you know, it's funny because it's my travels around the world, I realize the politicians are the people that screw things up. The people are always nice. You know, people say the French are not nice. Yeah, they're very nice. Everyone's very nice everywhere.
Absolutely.
Which reminds me of your trips abroad and the missions and how you found yourself in a situation where the equipment you wanted wasn't there, the medicines you wanted weren't there. That must have been.
Yeah, this was our trip to Romania. And if you asked me, if you said, David, what were the most significant weeks of your medical practice? It would be the first week of my internship where I was just scared to death. Certainly the week in Romania. And we went on a mission to Romania with Operation Smile, wonderful organization. And it was a 9-story pediatric hospital in Pitești, Romania. And they had one anesthesiologist for the whole hospital. And they called for an anesthesiologist to go to the ER, and I was the only one available between cases. So I ran down and I came into the ER, and they didn't have anything that we have in America. They didn't have any monitors. They didn't have any suction. They had people, and they had a nurse that could manually take a blood pressure and take a pulse. And I had a little gypsy boy that had been hit by a bus. And at first I thought, oh, he's dead. He's just gray. He wasn't breathing. And I went over to him, and I got an Ambu bag, and I gave him oxygen, and he pinked up. And okay, so he's alive, but he's gravely ill. And I put a breathing tube in him, and then I could examine him, and it looked like it was only a closed head injury and some terrible abrasions. And when you have a head injury, you have to worry about a neck injury. So you want to stabilize it with a cervical collar. So I asked for that. And a nurse came back with a cardboard box. She said, we don't have any collars, sir, but we have this. And I gently put his head in a box and taped it. And the only chance of him living would be if he had bleeding in his brain that could be evacuated. So I said, his only chance is if he's got that and he needs an emergency CT scan. And they said, the only CT scan in Romania is in Bucharest, 90 miles away. And I was just floored, because in Nashville at the time, we had 25 CT scanners, some of them in shopping malls. And we put him in an ambulance and off he went. And I heard later that night that he had died. But that's one of those cases that never leave you.
When you talk about Operation Smile and the Smile Train, because I adopted a little girl from China who had a cleft lip and a cleft palate and all kinds of other things.
Good for you.
And she had already been, we saw pictures of her before, which like you said, are graphic, but she's great. I can tell, it's your book. I don't want to talk about my daughter.
I've liked you right away, but I like you even better now. That's so wonderful.
Well, we adopted two daughters from China, one from Xi'an, where the terracotta soldiers are, and one from farther south near Guangzhou. Yeah. Talk about, you know, like the best weeks of your life, you know.
Yes. And I think the name of that chapter is Expectations.
Yeah.
When you get in that setting, it just resets your whole expectations. And you know a lot of people have a sort of entitlement mentality to them, and a lot of physicians, you know, we're a spoiled bunch, you know, at the hospital there's a lot of people to take care of us. And you know, one of the things my wife would say is, you're not at the hospital now, because the most frequent thing I would say would be, I need, and then whatever it was, there it was. Someone, you know, handed it to me or gave it to me. So nothing like going to a third world nation and taking care of kids to really set your perspective and your expectations.
One thing you said in that chapter was, you know, and they said it when I went to China too, is, you know, if Annie hadn't had that operation, I don't know what she'd be doing in China. Maybe sweeping dirt floors. Maybe she would just be abandoned. But the doctor said, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. It changes everything.
Yes. And, you know, we were at the Nashville airport, and we're going to head down. After the Romania trip, we said, that's it. You know, it took 26 hours to get there. We're staying in the Western Hemisphere. So we took a bunch of trips to Central America and South America. And we were taking one of them, and one of my very best friends in the world, we took a bunch, he's Mick Saggio in the book. He turned to me and he said, you know, David, it's an hour and a half of our life. It's the rest of their life.
Yeah.
It's and, really and what, Sam, what a gift to be able to participate in something like that. Nothing more rewarding.
Well, taking you back home, there's that one chapter, well, I've forgotten the name, with the infant, and you know, you couldn't bring her back, and the reverence in which the doctor sewed her back up. But then there was that orderly that said that horrible thing. I would have gone over and punched him in the face.
Yeah, that.
I act like everyone knows the book, but only I.
You know what? I'm so happy that you have that response. You know, I wanted to sort of unveil the secret world of anesthesia. Nobody's ever written a book about the OR and the ICU by an anesthesiologist or an anesthetist. It's this. Right. You know, we have a different perspective. There's tons of surgeon books out there. So I wanted to, you know, pull the surgical drapes off and show the world, you know, what we do, why we do it, how we do it, our secret language and all that kind of stuff. But far more than that, I wanted to touch people's hearts. And when you react like that, I think, oh, that's what I wanted. And this chapter, this is the second one, and it's called Dignity. And we had about a one-year-old baby, a complex cardiac case, who died on the table. And when it came time to close the chest, the chief resident, rather than just hurry it up, you know, because she's going to be buried in a few days, he was absolutely meticulous. He closed the skin as if she would have a bikini in 16 years. And the dressing was perfect. And here I go back. I'm in a room. And then an orderly said, shh, don't wake the baby, you know, as if, yeah, let's laugh about this. And of course, Dr. Holcomb exploded and, you know, dismissed him from the room. And it just so affected me about treating patients with dignity, whether they're alive or dead. And the chief resident, Dr. Holcomb, I had not talked to in over 40 years. And I found his address and I sent him a copy of the book and we've reconnected.
That's great.
And I was able to tell him, Ken, you were a mentor of mine. I just have never told you. I'm 40 years late in telling you.
This is, writing this book, it was so purgative for you, and you're reestablishing relationships that you wouldn't otherwise. It's one of the many, many reasons you should be glad you wrote it.
Well, yes. And, you know, at my little celebration the other day, a dear friend, one of my ex-partners and his wife, I had read the introduction about it's a privilege to take care of you. And she texted me and she said, you know, I've been visiting with kids at Vanderbilt Children's Hospital with our comfort dog. And I've been telling them when I leave, I was happy to visit you. And she said, now I'm telling them it was a privilege to visit you. And that's the effect that I want the book to have.
Definitely does. You know, you talk about, when we're talking about this orderly and horrible thing, but you also talk about when in a routine surgery that goes well, the doctors will be talking about football games and where they went to a restaurant and all that kind of stuff. But you don't talk about what I thought happened all the time, which was the kind of gallows humor that you do to relieve tension. And I wonder why you didn't talk about that, because I thought it was like really prevalent.
Well, it was more prevalent in the past because there was a lot of, you know, it's a lot of body talk, a lot of, you know, off color talk, a lot of, you know, sexual innuendo talk. There's a lot of talk that you're not allowed to talk anymore. And so I think people are a lot more careful about what they say. I think with that, there is a little bit less gallows humor, but still, you know, you do relieve tension by sometimes, you know, saying something that is a little bit macabre, just as a way to say, yeah, man, this is pretty heavy, isn't it?
What about when you go out on a limb like you do in one of the, you know, the guy who calls you and said, my last DIC patients, two of them have died. Here's another one. But when all hope is kind of seemingly lost, you talk about cooling him down, which was not necessarily accepted.
Okay. That's two cases. The DIC then led into my daughter having DIC. And it's easy to get the, you know, listen, I know the, you know, I'm the doctor. I know all these. I can't expect you to keep them straight. But the cooling case was the cardiac arrest. And this gets into the whole idea of how is it that you can have such an improbable save? It's, to me, it's grace. And we had a cardiac arrest in the OR and we jumped on it quick, but we got him back and he didn't wake up. And after an hour, he's still deeply comatose. And we brought him upstairs. And at that time, there was the American Heart Association had just come out with guidelines that if you have an out of hospital arrest and they get to the hospital and they haven't gained consciousness, to cool them for a few days. And by the way, the safety from the Bills undoubtedly got cooled. Damar Hamlin.
Right.
Yeah. When they said he's sedated, well, he was cooled and sedated. But you cool them to try to reduce the metabolic needs of the brain. You cool them for a couple of days and then sedate them, and then you warm them up and hopefully wake them up. And I call the ICU doc as he's coming upstairs, and I said, hey, man, we got to cool him. And he said, the American Heart Association guidelines don't call for that. Someone from the OR. And I said, we've got nothing to lose. Let's cool him. And he did. And 2 days later, he did wake up and make a full recovery. And it was just one of those things that you say, well, if the surgeon hadn't looked up and seen the nurse anesthetist struggling and hadn't said, let's call Dr. Alfrey, and I hadn't been right outside the door, and I hadn't said, and they didn't call me stat, and if I hadn't come right into the room and all these other things, he would have perished. And it's like the person that, you know, they got the flat tire and they didn't make the plane and then it goes down and you wonder, how does that happen?
That brings me to, because in the beginning you aren't, but it brings me to your discovery of faith. And I'd like to talk about that because I don't have that same kind of faith. And I wonder if yours is more, I don't know, nebulous than specific, how you got it and if you still have it.
Well, I grew up in what was, my father said was an agnostic family, but he would also declare, understand this, there is no God. So, you know, he was far into the agnosticism. And as I got into medicine, I was really, really deeply disturbed with all the tragedy that I saw. You know, it takes a toll over time. And I thought, if the end result of all of this is, whether it's in 20 minutes or, I mean, I'm 20 years or 70 years, we're gone, why bother take the trip? And I had married a really seriously Christian woman. And right. I just started on a spiritual journey, talked to a bunch of friends, read a bunch of books, talked to a bunch of pastors. And I just found that, you know, being a follower of Christ was right for me. And it, as I say in the epilogue, it hasn't given me all the answers, but it's allowed me to ask fewer questions.
Well, you know, what about, you know, the God, you know, God works in mysterious, the Lord works in mysterious ways, or if there's a benevolent God, how does he allow this to happen? How did you reconcile that with your faith?
You know, I can't reconcile it in the sense that I can't answer it. And, you know, the book by the rabbi, I can't remember the name of it. Why do bad things happen to good people? Huge, famous bestseller. I think his conclusion was, you know, I can't reconcile why this happens. I'm too small to understand that. I'm too small to understand what's at the end of the universe. or, you know, the idea that time can change. All I can do is decide how I'm going to respond to this world. And I'll do that in my faith. I'll do it as a Christian, which is to be generous, to be kind, and all the other things, understanding that most of the faiths in the world share those same principles, and most of those without faith share those principles as well.
It reminds me of the quote you put in there by Einstein, you know, about miracles. You know,
yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, talk about that, because it goes to a lot of, especially for an anesthesiologist, it goes to, you can either believe life is a miracle. Go ahead. You talk.
Yeah. Well, it was when the guy that we cooled awakened and had a full recovery. And then I quoted Einstein as saying, you can look at life two ways, either that there are no miracles or that everything's a miracle. You know, just knowing how intricate we are, the way we're put together, how intricate the world is, how intricate the universe is, I just have to think everything's a miracle.
Well, there you go. Damar Hamlin, you mentioned him. So in that situation, you know, what was a miracle was he happened to be in exactly the right place at the right time for that to happen. Not only the ambulance, but the people who attended him immediately. And I was wondering, now that he's been released, and you've had this happen all the time, seems to me like, based on how they attended to him so quickly, that he might just, well, it happened to Dick Cheney five times, that he might just go on to live a normal life and even go back to play football.
Yeah, they're speculating that he had something called commotio cordis. You know, doctors have to have these Latin terms so we confuse everybody. And commotio cordis translates as agitation of the heart. And I'm sure he's had the million-dollar workup now. And, you know, just to see if there's anything intrinsically wrong with his heart. There's something called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And then there's just other causes for a cardiac arrest like that. And if they are all ruled out, then he had commotio cordis. And that is when you get struck in the chest really hard, transmitted to the heart, and at a very specific time in the ECG cycle, the upslope of the T wave, it can put you into ventricular fibrillation. There's probably less than 20 cases in the US every year. So if you get it, you're really unlikely. And it happens more often in males and in baseball players because they get hit with a line drive.
Right.
And it's not an argument to not play baseball or football, but it is an argument to have an external cardiac defibrillator at all these sporting events if that rare thing happens. And it's presumed that that's what he had, commotio cordis.
My nephews for my 70th birthday bought me a defibrillator. The best gift I've ever gotten.
That's I've never heard of that before. That's
it's the best gift in the world for someone my age.
Yeah.
But it's funny because one of my coworkers, he goes, "Oh, that's great. You got it. Can you use it on yourself? Can you do it yourself?" I said, "No, you can't."
But teach those around you how to use it.
Well, my father, before he died, in our company, they were giving CPR classes, and he was walking by, and the human resources lady said, "You need to come in and learn it too." He goes, "No, you're doing it for me." And he died of sudden cardiac arrest. He stood up between Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy, and he said, "I feel dizzy." And that was it.
Yeah.
To die, it's a good way to go.
Yeah. You know what? We should all be so lucky.
Yeah. I could tell you stories about my mom, but we could go on and on. Actually, we've been talking for a while. So in conclusion, I was thinking, okay, you know, you've had a full life. You've helped so many people. You've developed so many devices that can help them more. So you wrote this book. So what are you going to do now?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I've got a lot more stories inside. And depending upon how this book does, and, you know, and I've decided that my measure of success is going to be people contacting me and saying, you know what, this really changed my life. This really affected my life, or it really touched my heart. So if it's successful in that regard, I'll probably tell 15 more stories. I play guitar and I'm in Nashville, so that's very intimidating. I've played guitar all my life, play it poorly, but you know, we're the same vintage. So I go upstairs and play along to the Allman Brothers and the Stones and whoever.
That's great. Yeah. How old are you?
I'm 74.
Okay. And I'd be 71. Yeah. So you and I listen to the same music. I went to Woodstock.
That's right. And you know, I heard your podcast last night about Creedence, and I thought I should tell you the story. I'm in New Orleans between medical school and college, and a legendary place opens called The Warehouse. And the first night they had a band from Chicago, The Flock. They had Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac back when it was the blues band.
Then Play On was way better than afterwards.
And they had this hippie band from San Francisco, The Grateful Dead. And a guy came into town with them, Stanley Oswald, the Acid King. And they played at the warehouse. And that night, where I was working with my friend Pete, we were invited to a party down at the Royal Sonesta Hotel with the Grateful Dead. And we thought, you know, this was the height of the psychedelic era, and we were definitely a part of that. And we said, you know, man, the Gremion brothers, the chief of police, the assistant chief of police, this town is so hot. I can't believe it, but we're not going to go. Now, that's the way I remembered it. Pete remembers it as we were too stoned to go, but we didn't go. And the next day in the Times-Picayune is Stanley Oswald in handcuffs. Everybody got arrested. Everybody went to the New Orleans Parish jail. They wrote the song Truckin'
on that.
They said, we're never coming back to New Orleans. They did 20 years later, but imagine how that would have changed my life if I was in that.
Yeah. Film. Yeah. I'm thinking the lyrics are running through my head right now.
Yeah. Set up like a bowling pin. Well, if you got a
knock down.
Yeah, you got a warrant, I guess you come in.
Well, that's a strange way to end the interview.
Well, I thought it would be a curveball. You know, well, the senior doctor.
That's great. It's so funny how you change in life. I mean, like they say, you know, if you can remember being a Woodstock, you weren't there.
By the way, I love that podcast. You know, I really connected. I connected with you and I connected with the author.
Yeah, I just still at the end, I thought, you know, basically it's just John Fogerty. You know, he could have had any backup band.
Yeah.
I thought. He tried to convince me otherwise because he was interviewing Stu Cook.
Yeah.
Why am I, we should, we're trying to sell your book.
Well.
So here's how we're going to end. Okay. So obviously your book is in the front table of my bookstore, and we have lots of book clubs, and one's a nonfiction book club. And this will definitely be coming up on either in the next couple of months. And I'm really looking forward to it. And actually, if you're available, I have a TV screen there and we can talk and maybe you can zoom in.
I'd love to.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's do that.
This has been such fun.
Oh yeah, it really has been. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks so much for writing the book. And as you said, I'm not trying to kiss your butt, but yeah, it definitely has changed my life and gave me a completely different perspective. And the other thing that's really cool is you're a good writer.
Well, you know, I was an English major in college. You know, I was pre-med originally and it was too hard, so I quit. And then I graduated and said, you know, you really do want to be a doctor. So I had to go back and take the pre-med. But thank you for the compliment.
It's a good combination.
Yeah.
Really good combination.
Well thanks for being in the other Zoom.
Okay. We'll schedule it as soon as we can.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.